Thank you. Hi, everyone. So I'm Kelsey Mirkovich. I'm with the CDC, and I have no relationships to disclose that have existed during the past 12 months. So now I'd like to start by pointing out the benefits of breastfeeding, which I believe everybody knows. But since I have it here, and for the sake of time, I'm going to go through this slide. So, breastfeeding provides optimal nutrition for infants, benefits for infants, mothers, and society. Health benefits for infants include lower risk for several infections and diseases. For mothers, lower risk for breast and ovarian cancers. And for societies, increasing breastfeeding could lower healthcare costs. I know this has been brought up. A 2010 study found an estimated $2.2 billion savings in direct medical costs. So the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months, followed by continued breastfeeding for the first 12 months or longer as complementary foods are introduced. Our most recent national estimates correspond to children who were born in 2011, where 79% of mothers initiated breastfeeding. However, only about 49% of infants were breastfeeding at 6 months, and only 27% of infants were being breastfed at 12 months as recommended. An even lower percentage of infants were exclusively breastfed as recommended. At 3 months, only 41% of infants were exclusively breastfeeding, and only 19% were exclusively breastfeeding at 6 months. So increasing U.S. breastfeeding rates is a national health objective. Indeed, the Healthy People 2020 objectives include several breastfeeding-related objectives. These include increase in the proportion of infants who are ever breastfed, breastfeeding at 6 months, at 12 months, and exclusively breastfeeding at 3 months and 6 months. Increasing the proportion of employers with worksite lactation programs, which we just heard about. Reducing the proportion of breastfed newborns who receive supplementation within the first 2 days. And increasing the proportion of births that occur in facilities that provide the optimal care for lactating mothers and babies. Increasing national breastfeeding rates also stimulated the release of the 2011 Surgeon General's call to action to support breastfeeding. So this included 20 action steps to be taken by different groups of people. And I'd like to point out that both the Healthy People 2020 objectives and the call to action to support breastfeeding include actions and indicators to measure employer support for breastfeeding women. So this is on everyone's radar and is an important strategy right now. This is likely because there's a large number of working mothers in the U.S. In 2012, approximately 58% of U.S. mothers with children under 1 year of age participated in the workforce, where 63% of them returned to work at more than 35 hours per week. So this tells us that breastfeeding support for working moms has the potential to impact many families. Most recent strategies to improve and promote breastfeeding for working mothers have been worksite accommodations, including recent legislation that provides mandatory provisions of places and time to express milk. However, relatively little attention has been placed to the provision of paid maternity leave in the U.S. So that is until President Obama spoke about U.S. maternity leave situation with two frequently cited quotes. So the United States is the only developed country in the world without paid maternity leave. Another quote from him: only 3 countries in the world report that they don't offer paid maternity leave. 3, and the U.S. is one of them. Who are the other 2 countries? Out of 167 countries reviewed by the International Labor Organization, the only other 2 countries that do not provide mandatory paid maternity leave for new mothers are Swaziland and Papua New Guinea. Studies have shown that mothers with shorter maternity leave and mothers who return to work at full-time work status have lower breastfeeding initiation rates and shorter breastfeeding duration. So knowing that others have shown this, we were still left with 2 important questions. The first is, how does a mother's prenatally anticipated maternity leave duration and return status influence her postnatal feeding plans? And the second, Are the shorter durations of breastfeeding observed for mothers who return to work earlier and or full time a result of mothers who are planning to breastfeed for a shorter duration then returning earlier to paid employment? We started with this first question. How does a mother's prenatally anticipated maternity leave duration and return status influence her postnatal feeding plan? Understanding how a mother's anticipated maternity leave may influence her postnatal feeding plans is important because prenatal intention to breastfeed is one of the strongest predictors of how a mother will feed her infant. In fact, one study showed that a mother who expressed a definite intention to breastfeed were 26 times more likely to initiate breastfeeding than those with only a tentative intention. To answer both questions, we use data from the Infant Feeding Practices Study 2. This is a longitudinal survey that's conducted as a collaborative effort between the FDA and CDC, and it was conducted between 2005 and 2007. Mothers were recruited in their third trimester of pregnancy through a consumer opinion mail panel, and then followed for the first 12 postnatal months. Inclusion criteria for the IFPS2 survey were that mothers be at least 18 years of age, carrying a singleton baby, born after gestation week 35, weighing at least 5 pounds, and that both mother and infant be without medical condition that could affect feeding. The first questionnaire was sent to mothers during her third trimester of pregnancy, and then almost monthly questionnaires were collected by mail during the first 12 postnatal months. Mothers were asked a variety of topics related to infant feeding and care practices, and mothers were also asked questions related to employment on a subset of these surveys. To answer our first question, we used data collected from expectant mothers during their third trimester of pregnancy. We limited our sample to expectant mothers who were prenatally employed and intended to return to work during their baby's first year. Our analytic sample included 2,361 expectant mothers. The outcome in this study was how a mother planned to feed her baby in the first few weeks postpartum. Expectant mothers were asked what method they planned to use to feed their baby in the first few weeks postpartum and given 4 optional responses: breastfeed only, formula feed only, both breast and formula feed, and I don't know. The 96 women who answered I don't know were excluded from our study. Mothers who responded breastfeed only were categorized as intending to exclusively breastfeed. We considered 2 predictor variables. The first was anticipated maternity leave duration, and the second was anticipated return status. To categorize anticipated maternity leave duration, we used responses from a question that asked expectant mothers how many weeks after their baby was born were they planning to return to work. And the responses were categorized into 3 categories: greater than or equal to 13 weeks, 7 to 12 weeks, and less than or equal to 6 weeks. Expectant mothers were also asked how many hours per week they planned to return to work after they returned. And we categorized their anticipated return to work status as either part-time if they plan to return at less than 30 hours per week, or full-time if they plan to return to work 30 hours per week or more. All analyses were conducted using SAS 9.3, and statistical significance was set at alpha equals 0.05. Bivariate analysis was used to describe how a mother's feeding plan was associated with her plans for maternity leave and return status, and to describe how socio-demographic characteristics were associated with plans to exclusively breastfeed. Logistic regression was used to describe how prenatally anticipated maternity leave and return status were associated with a mother's plans to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks postpartum, and we adjusted for the listed potential confounders. In this table, I'm showing the percent of expectant mothers planning to take the listed duration of maternity leave in the top half of the table, and the percent of expectant mothers planning to return to work part-time versus full-time in the bottom half of the table. Overall, 18.8% of expectant mothers in our study anticipated a maternity leave duration of 13 weeks or more. This was compared with 35.6% who anticipated taking 6 weeks or less. Among our sample, 59.9% of expectant mothers prenatally planned to return to work full-time. I have added the percent of mothers planning to exclusively breastfeed, formula feed, and breastfeed and exclusively formula feed in the first few weeks postpartum by their anticipated maternity leave duration on the top half of the table and part-time or full-time return status on the bottom half of the table. 69.5% of expectant mothers planning to return to work after 12 weeks plan to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks, versus 52.8% of expectant mothers who plan to return to work within 6 weeks. Consistent with this, 9.3% of expectant mothers anticipating to return to work after 12 weeks plan to exclusively formula feed, compared with 18.8% of expectant mothers who anticipated returning within 6 weeks. 66.3% of expectant mothers planning to return part-time plan to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks versus 55% who plan to return full-time. Likewise, 13.1% of expectant mothers planning to return part-time plan to exclusively formula feed versus 16.5% of mothers who plan to return full-time. This slide shows some of the socio-demographic characteristics of our study population and the percent planning to exclusively breastfeed by socio-demographic characteristics. Overall, 59.5% of expectant mothers plan to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks postpartum, which varied significantly by maternal age, race ethnicity, marital status, and poverty income ratio. I'd like to point out a few of these characteristics statistics in the table. To start with, only 45.5% of Black expectant mothers plan to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks, compared with 61.2% of white expectant mothers. Similarly, 52.7% of married women plan to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks, of unmarried women plan to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks, compared with 64.7% of married women. This slide shows some additional socio-demographic characteristics. Planning to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks postpartum also varied statistically by maternal education, pre-pregnancy BMI, parity, and participation in a special supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children, also known as WIC. I would like to highlight that only 45.4% of expectant mothers with a high school degree or less plan to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks, compared with 70.2% of expectant mothers who were college graduates or higher educated. All of these significant predictors were included as covariates in our model. This table displays the odds of planning to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks postpartum after adjusting for the potential confounders. Expectant mothers who were prenatally planned to return to work between 7 and 12 weeks had 0.72 times the odds of planning to exclusively breastfeed in the first few weeks. And expectant mothers planning to return within 6 weeks had 0.60 times the odds of prenatally planning to exclusively breastfeed, compared with expectant mothers who plan to return to work 12 weeks or later, after 12 weeks. In addition, expectant mothers who plan to return to work full-time had 0.61 times the odds of planning to exclusively breastfeed compared with expectant mothers planning to return to work full-time or part-time. Our study had the following limitations. IFPS2 is nationally distributed, but it is not nationally representative. Mothers were more likely to be older, white, and more highly educated, all factors associated with better breastfeeding practices. And this reduces the generalizability of our findings. We cannot determine the directionality of the association with this study. We cannot determine if women who have limited maternity leave then do not plan to exclusively breastfeed, or if women who plan not to exclusively breastfeed arrange to return to work earlier. There was also a relatively large number of expectant mothers for whom we did not have information regarding their marital status and/or education status, and these women were categorized as other for these two variables. strengths of Arden study included its national scope, large sample size, and prenatal administration, which minimizes recall bias. From this analysis, we identified an association between prenatal plans for maternity leave duration and return to work status with the mother's plans for infant feeding in the first few weeks postpartum. We showed that mothers have lower odds of intending to exclusively breastfeed if they plan to return to work any time before 12 weeks and or return at full time. I would now like to transition into the second question, which was, are shorter durations of breastfeeding observed from mothers who plan to work or work earlier or full time a result of mothers planning to breastfeed for a shorter duration, returning earlier to paid employment? I showed this slide earlier in the talk and told you that previous studies have shown that mothers with shorter maternity leaves and mothers who return to work at full-time schedules have lower breastfeeding initiation and shorter breastfeeding duration. However, these studies do not consider the possibility of reverse causality. That is, that mothers who are planning to breastfeed for a shorter duration are then returning earlier to paid employment. To address this issue, we included only mothers who prenatally intended to breastfeed for at least 3 months. We assessed the impact of maternity leave duration with part-time or full-time return status on the ability of a mother to meet her own intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months. For this analysis, again, we used data from the Infant Feeding Practices Study 2 cohort. During the third trimester of pregnancy, women were asked how long they intended to breastfeed, and then asked on all postnatal surveys the age of their child when breastfeeding stopped. A mother was classified as meeting her intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months if her breastfeeding duration was 3 months or longer. At postnatal months 3, 6, 9, and 12, mothers were asked the age of their baby when they returned to paid employment and the number of hours per week which they usually worked. Part-time status was defined as less than 30 hours per week, and full-time status was defined as 30 hours per week or more. Answers to these five questions were used to categorize mothers into five exposure categories based on their actual maternity leave duration and return status. Not working at 3 months, return to work between 6 weeks and 3 months part-time, return to work before 6 weeks part-time, return to work between 6 weeks and 3 months full-time, and return to work before 6 weeks full-time. Again, all analyses were conducted using SAS 9.3, where statistical significance was set at alpha equals 0.05. Logistic regression was used to assess the impact of maternity leave duration with part-time or full-time status on the ability of a mother to meet her own intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months, and we adjusted for the listed potential confounders. In our sample of women who intended to breastfeed for at least 3 months, the mean duration of intended breastfeeding was 9.9 months, and 44% of mothers intended to breastfeed for 12 months or longer. This slide shows some of the sociodemographic characteristics of our study population and the percent of mothers who did not meet their intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months. Overall, 28.8% of mothers in our sample did not meet their own intentions to breastfeed for at least 3 months. Almost half of mothers 18 to 24 years of age who intended to breastfeed for at least 3 months did not meet their intention. Similarly, approximately 40% of Black and Hispanic mothers did not meet their own intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months, compared with 27.8% of white mothers. Again, almost half of married or of unmarried mothers did not meet their 3 month breastfeeding intention, compared with 23.5% of married mothers. This slide shows additional sociodemographic characterizations of our study population and the percent of mothers who did not meet their intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months. Maternal education, parity, and WIC participation were all significant predictors of meeting the 3-month breastfeeding intention. This table shows the percentage of mothers who did not meet their 3-month breastfeeding intention by their duration of maternity leave and part-time or full-time return status. Again, 28.8% of mothers in our study did not meet their own intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months. 27.6% of mothers not working at 3 months did not meet their intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months, compared with 42.4% of mothers who returned to work full-time within 6 weeks. Mothers who returned to work full-time before 6 weeks had 2.25 times the odds of mothers not meeting their own intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months, and mothers who returned after 6 weeks but before 3 months had 1.82 times the odds of not meeting their intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months, compared with mothers not working at 3 months. No statistical difference in the ability of a mother to meet her intention to breastfeed for at least 6 months or at least 3 months was observed for mothers who returned to work part-time. Again, our study had the following limitations. ISPS2 is nationally distributed but not nationally representative. All mothers in this analysis were more likely to be older, white, and more highly educated, which again are factors associated with better breastfeeding outcomes. This again reduces the generalizability of our findings. Mothers reported their average work hours on the first survey they completed after returning to work, which may have changed over time. Strengths of our study include the frequency of postpartum questionnaires to reduce recall bias, and breastfeeding intentions were reported prenatally, allowing us to factor this into our analysis. In summary, mothers who return to work full-time before 3 months, particularly those who return to work before 6 weeks, are less likely to meet their own intentions to breastfeed for at least 3 months. The maternity leave duration a mother takes is likely influenced by the amount of paid leave she's granted and the amount of unpaid leave she can afford to take. The 2011 Surgeon General Call to Action to Support Breastfeeding included Action 13, which called for work toward establishing paid maternity leave for all employed mothers. Results from these studies suggest that prenatally planning to return to work full-time or before 12 weeks may reduce the likelihood a mother plans to exclusively breastfeed. And similarly, returning to work before 3 months may reduce a mother's ability to meet her own intention to breastfeed for at least 3 months. After considering the possibility of reverse causality in our second analysis, our results support earlier studies that showed shorter durations of breastfeeding among mothers who returned to full-time work earlier. We conclude that longer maternity leave or employer support for part-time return scheduling may help more women exclusively breastfeed and achieve their own breastfeeding goals, which may increase the number of babies being breastfed as recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. While we were not able to use the ISPS2 dataset to assess the impact of paid maternity leave on breastfeeding outcomes, policies that provide paid maternity leave for all new mothers may be a way to ensure that working mothers who have the ability to focus on infant care for the first few weeks postpartum. 5 states have implemented some form of paid maternity leave policy for all or most of their working mothers. These include California, New Jersey, Rhode Island, New York, and Hawaii. Several other states have proposed bills or pending bills. There is significant variability among states with respect to the duration of paid leave, the fraction of mothers' wage which is paid during the leave, and the way the states are funding the leave, and the amount of job protection that's guaranteed during the leave. There's also current legislation proposed for a national paid leave policy called the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act, or FAMILY Act. It essentially converts the current unpaid Family Medical Leave Act, or FMLA, into a paid policy, and it expands it to include a greater proportion of the workforce. And under the FAMILY Act, all workers which would include new mothers, would be eligible for up to 12 weeks of partial income replacement at 66% of a worker's monthly wage to a capped amount. And it would be funded by an employee and employer payroll contributions of 0.2% of wages. This amounts to about $1.50 per week for a person making a $39,000 a year salary. Based on the results of our study, a policy that guarantees new mothers 12 weeks of paid maternity leave may result in more working mothers choosing to initiate breastfeeding, and more working mothers able to breastfeed for the durations that they intend. Thank you for your time, and I'd now like to answer questions. So I'm going to invite all of our presenters to come on up, and then we'll open it to questions. If you can do us the grand favor of standing to ask your questions and telling us who you are, so that we know how to address you, that would be lovely. Come and join us. All right. Who would like to go first?
I'm Virgin Hope, and I'm with the Maternity Care Coalition of Philadelphia. We just got Philadelphia to change regulations that mandate employers under 50 employees to have breastfeeding areas in their facilities. One question is, and this is what we're struggling with now, is we're a small organization, so how do we go about helping this regulation be not only enforced, but educated about it.
I can't remember the website though. Mm-hmm. So the Office of Women's Health, along with, just launched a website that has a tremendous amount of employer information. If that's you're asking, really, to help employers move this forward.
Right. So they're not skipping.
Right. They have. So it's a fairly powerful tool, provides all kinds of impressive examples from very unique situations. So it covers the waterfront, interviews people. It has a lot of interactivity with it. It also allows people to kind of post what their best practices and experiences are. It's on the Office of Women's Health, so the federal website. If somebody in the audience remembers more detail what the title of it is, but it was a project that Kathy Carruthers worked on in collaboration with them, and it's a pretty impressive website. It was just released in June this past year. It's a business case for breastfeeding. It's the traditional one that's been there. I don't know whether the new one is labeled the same. Does anybody? But if you go on the Office of Women's Health website, the federal one, they got hacked. Oh, great. Yeah. Okay. But. Great. That sounds probably right. They all tend to sound alike, so I yeah, but it is a pretty impressive resource. They took a lot of time and thought, interviewed and visited a number of sites. I mean, and the level of creativity on there about how to solve this was phenomenal from my perspective.
Our next question. I know you have burning questions. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Rachel. I'm an EMP student. My question is from the studies that was done in Georgia and Rochester. Are there organizations that tend to support more apart from the number of employees? Are we talking about like healthcare organizations do a better job, do financial organizations do a better job? Are there organizations that are specifically better at it?
Yeah, thanks for your question. So you want to know whether the type of organization matters. Yeah, that's an interesting question because that's something we would like to know. But in our questionnaire, we didn't have an option. We didn't include a question for them to indicate the type of organization. However, we believe that we can get it because the company that has the database has the type of organization. So we hope to be able to link that data and include that factor. I know the research says that healthcare organizations do a good job at it, but I mean, we have to see if that's true.
We had the same limitation. It wasn't asked in a way to do that. Being from a large academic medical center, you'd think that we would have done this right. Yeah, not so much. But part of the issue is the penetration down into the organization. And I think that's where a lot of the challenge arises. So I wouldn't necessarily assume that healthcare organizations do it any better than anybody else. It really speaks very much to the need of people who are champions within the organization to be there to kind of call into question what's going on. And the other challenge, which I'm sure that you're experiencing, is who's filling out the survey. And there's a, you know, their perspective may be different than the on-the-ground perspective. I actually had a, we ended up being a clearinghouse for all the complaints about breastfeeding in our organization. So somebody actually called us and said that there was, that these PhDs in the lab were being told they couldn't breastfeed by their boss, who's also a PhD. And what are they studying? Vaccines. Really? Like, breastfeeding isn't seen as kind of the first vaccine? It was just unbelievable. And and we also discovered they were asking a woman if she was coming in, if she was going to be breastfeeding, because then they wouldn't hire her if she was going to be breastfeeding. I mean, it was just blatant. And so, I mean, it is, it happens in a lot of different pockets, which is a problem. So.
I have one better than you.
Oh, good.
Doctoral students could not use any area in her building that she had to walk up the hill and use the lactation room that's part of a university lactation support program. And we worked and worked. It was an Oriental student who feared that her dissertation would be knocked down. So we're still working on that. So don't assume. Okay, you need to do a task force or something and get, you know, do it if it's not done in your area. Don't let anybody else.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about the Georgia study. I was wondering what the funding, how you guys got funding to do that.
Well, we didn't have so much money. I think the survey cost about $13,500. And we got the funding from a SHAPE grant. So the SHAPE grant is something the governor is doing. So Governor Nathan Deal, something to do with physical activity, and we got some monies from there. So
in the back, and then we'll come to the front.
Hi there, Carol Burton. I'm an independent researcher in Vermont, and my question is, going back to that really wonderful presentation that you had from the CDC, I noticed that people who intended to breastfeed but then participated in WIC were less likely to continue breastfeeding than what they had anticipated. So I'm wondering if there would be the opportunity to work with WIC participants and advocating for workplace policy as they prepare to go back to work. Certainly there is a lot of support of the breastfeeding peer counselors, and I'm wondering if there might be a potential to bring in education on the lactation facilities and how to advocate for yourself.
I think that sounds like a great idea, and I would encourage states to try to figure out a way to engage their peer counselors. They have been invaluable. I can't think of any presentation I've ever been to where they haven't been. And I think we do forget about how hard it is for moms when they go back to work. You know, it's like, it's just another place. So thank you. Yeah, that's a great comment.
Right here.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Sinclair. I'm an RN at CLC at Bronx. In our hospital, we
California, about 60% of us are certified lactation counselors, and we're trying to increase our breastfeeding initiation rates within the first hour or within the first 3 days of life of the infant. But on the postpartum visit, we're finding that many of the mothers have stopped breastfeeding. I wondered if there were any questions in your survey about the hospital experience, and does that have anything to do with the decrease in the breastfeeding rates, or is it really mostly about the return to work?
That's a great question. Dr. Kriya Parine, she published a study using the same data set and using a question almost identical to what you had suggested. She looked at intentions of exclusive breastfeeding and then how quickly women drop off exclusively breastfeeding. And it actually looked like they were dropping off, like you said, within the first month. That's where she had cut it off. And so we don't think that jobs are what's hurting everybody. It seems like a lot of people quit breastfeeding really, really early on, and then it looks like to us, again, people have another barrier when they go back to work. And so I think you're right, that's the first barrier. And her paper looked at each of the baby friendly steps, but I can't remember if she looked at each step individually, if she looked at like the increase, the compounded, you know, one step versus two step versus three steps. But so what she found was that more, you know, better hospital practices did translate into better outcomes in the first few weeks, like you're suggesting. Yes? Oh,
sorry. Go ahead. Hi, I'm Jessica DeBerry with Maternal Child Health Bureau. Do you believe that a national paid maternity leave policy is in the foreseeable future?
Is that a question for me? So I think that we have more attention now to it than has ever been in the past, so that's good. There's still resistance. So I'm not the expert on the Family Act. I think that those people are here. But what I can say about it is that it's not just for paid maternity leave. They're really trying to shape it as paid family leave, so sick children, sick parents, a sick spouse. And I think the motivation behind this is to get a little bit more buy-in from the dads or the single men who say, I don't have a child, I'm never going to breastfeed a baby, I don't need this. And I think that it's important because I think at each point there's a time in your life where you need it. I think it's really encouraging that states are starting to do their own. I think that that's a good thing, but I think that it's important for the federal government to do it. Federal employees do not have paid maternity leave. That's a little known fact. And military personnel like myself have 6 weeks of paid, but no option for an additional six unpaid. So we go back after six regardless of whether or not we want to take additional time off. So I think starting with the federal government would be really a good place to start. But I think that it's coming. I also think that So this has been 10 years since the California paid leave policy went into place. I think it was 2013 that it went into place, and so now they're starting to collect some of the data to look at the better, you know, health outcomes with respect to breastfeeding and employer retention data with a decade of data. And I think that that'll be a good, hopefully that data looks good, and hopefully that'll push it forward. But I don't know if it's going to happen, but I think that, you know, we're getting there, and I think that President Obama talking about it has really raised the issue.
Right behind you. Just to follow up on the comment about hospital practice. Sorry, Marie Tanner from Hong Kong. I think if we look at certainly our breastfeeding studies we've looked at, is that the two biggest factors are hospital practices and return to work. And I think what happens with a lot of mothers, certainly some of our qualitative research has shown this, is that they get a bad start, they're going back to work, and they give up because what's the point? They've only got another 4 to 6 weeks or whatever they can breastfeed anyway. And so they don't get a good start in the hospital, and then they feel that they're sort of, why bother? But if they get a good start, then some of them can see that, oh, well, maybe I can keep this up.
And, you know, combine work and employment
and breastfeeding.
So, and I think some of the IFPS studies have
shown that. Mm-hmm. Did you want to comment on this? Yeah. Yeah, Sid. As a part of what I presented today was part of a larger study, and what we found was that support is very critical. You're absolutely right. Getting that good start in the hospital, mom having that positive experience, and realizing that she can work through and solve the problems, getting the support she needs to feel confident about solving problems makes all the difference in the world. The study was qualitative study, but we found that there is what we called acute need support. Typically happens in the first week. Those first few days in the hospital, that hospital experience is very important. But having someone there that can help the mom problem solve, because regardless of number of children, breastfeeding experience, whatever, moms find that first week to be really emotionally and mentally overwhelming, and so they need that support. When they have that support, they can successfully resolve the problems. They're more confident about their ability to solve the problems. They get their breastfeeding well established, and then it's easier when they return to work. They're able to overcome those barriers a little bit easier and continue and figure it out after they return to work.
Two comments. One has to do with WIC moms. So I know New York State has a brochure, a small brochure about all your rights as a breastfeeding mother, and part of that is communicating with your employer, and they have standard materials that a woman can take to her employer that talks about her rights and those kinds of things. I don't know how widespread that is across WIC, but I would assume that many states have. But because some of the rules are state specific, it really isn't a national piece. It would have to be state defined. I'm sorry. I haven't a clue, but I'm assuming it is that it would be. So you could go on the New York State WIC website and look to see that. If not, give me a call. I can send you some samples of that. The other piece has to do with the priority of where, of how are we going to get the Family Act passed. So APHA is an advocacy organization. So when we periodically talk to Don Hoppert, who leads the advocacy efforts of APHA, in fact, we asked him, I think it was last March, I realize this is a while ago, kind of where did he see that and the other similar legislation. And, you know, APHA determines where it's going to put its advocacy efforts because it is not an infinite resource. And they were not putting their efforts toward this. It's not that they wouldn't sign on letters or whatever, but they weren't going to try to push this as an agenda because their sense was that the environment was not yet ready for that to be successful. And they didn't think that they're putting more effort behind it would change that. Frankly, with the election of last week, I'm less hopeful that we're going to make progress in the next couple of years, since the folk who are managing this are much more employer-oriented, et cetera, than there. But that's, you know, my 25-cent read. As APHA members, though, you can, you know, push and ask the organization to take this on. It is a member organization. They do respond to the requests of the members. I would also encourage you, if you haven't signed up for the legislative updates from Don Hopper, to get on those and to then communicate to your legislators, et cetera, to be, it's a really easy way to be an advocate for public health legislation that's going forward.
And if you go on the APHA advocacy site, there's like things that you can like click on to email your senator now, and it has standard language. The Family Act actually is one of them that the forum and the MCH and the International Health and the Food and Nutrition section work together, but led by the forum to get going. So you can do that today. It'd be great. I'm going to take a little moderator privilege, and I'm going to ask a question of this side and a question of this side. So we'll start over here. So in your study, it was very interesting to me that the group that had the best support for lactation was the employers that had a non-majority of women. And as our feminist colleague and then our data person here who showed it, I'd like you to talk about why you think that might be, and are we really just that bad at supporting one another? So that's me, you guys. And then on this side, you know, one of the things about employers, and when we talk about full-time versus part-time, is they define it differently. So in order to be full-time and benefits eligible, you have to be employed for 36 hours. So some of the support programs might not actually be available to those that are considered part-time. So I'd like to hear what you guys think about that. So I'm going to now shut up and turn it over. You all want to go first?
I'll start.
I also found that to be very interesting in your presentation. One of the things that we see in the literature is that coworkers are supportive of breastfeeding moms as long as it does not increase their own workload or impinge on them in any way. So I have to wonder if that is the factor that in businesses that have more female employees, if it's the type of work that they're doing, that, and I'm thinking in terms of things like call centers or retail outlets, those kinds of things, where it's a customer service base, and so somebody has to cover that position or somebody has to cover that time, and so it creates an extra burden on the other female employees. That just, I'm curious if that's the case, but I also found it very interesting.
So thank you for the question. I noticed that when I was making up my slides, and I wondered, how come? Because I would have thought that those who had more than 50% would have the highest odds. So I wondered at that myself. But then I reasoned that and said, well, maybe those that have more than 50%, well, most of them are women, so that, like, if you need to breastfeed, we don't have accommodations for you because another woman, we can employ somebody else. So let's say 70% are women. That means if they don't accommodate you and you leave, they can get somebody else, because women are not that special in that organization. I was just wondering, because most are women, so if you need breastfeeding and we can't help you, we'll get somebody else. But I think what will make the difference is if we had the organization type. I think that's something we're missing. You know, so if we had the type of organization, maybe that would tell which organizations have mostly women, and does that make a difference? So I hope to get that data. Thank you.
Right. I'll go over to my other side and talk about time.
So you're talking. So your question was,
so
part-time.
Full-time, for benefits eligible definition of full-time, it's 36 hours per week. So some of the programs and supports and break times and those types of things are more eligible. Mm-hmm. You're able to use them if you work full-time, versus a part-time person who might not be able to use them. And so are your might your findings be different, because maybe the problem is. Is 30 is not catching.
So I'm curious where you've gotten 36 hours. We tried to look it up and we found that there's no federal standard definition. For example, CDC, it's 19 hours is when you become part-time and 20 is full-time.
So every hospital I've ever worked for, and there's a lot of them, and every university, they use 36 hours. That seems a very private sector standard. Okay. 36 hours is benefits eligible. Actually, McDonald's, Burger King, Walgreens, CVS, they all use that one.
So that would be interesting. Yeah, so that's interesting. So I think that just speaks to the variability. I mean, at least, so, and I'm surprised. So I've worked at two private companies and both have been 30. So I'm very surprised to hear that it's been so consistent. We had to make an arbitrary decision where to do a cutoff. Our categorizations were, what was it, less than 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 30. And so we chose 30 because it was the most relevant. The Department of Labor collects statistics based on 35 or above, inclusive of 35, which I think would actually have been a better number. But it's interesting to think that there might really be a difference in that kind of small 30 to 35% range. And I don't know the answer to it because we can't look at that. But it's interesting. That's variable.
Yeah. Well, and I was wondering in your survey, maybe you asked hours, not a like or variable. Okay. Yeah. No. Because that one of those things that in working that Anne and I are working on together, we do see a difference. If you pick 32 as the cut point instead of 30 or 36, and so it's that idea of 32 would be 4 days a week.
FMLA is what 32, I think, if you do the calculation. My sister's a nurse and she's a 0.5. And she can't go to 0.4 after she had a baby because she's going to lose all of her benefits. And so it's very interesting.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily have anything to add to those comments, other than some of you may or may not be aware that part of the pushback for the Affordable Care Act is now how they're defining full-time in terms of eligibility for insurance, and that there is some push to define it as 40, which means that employers would only have to you provide insurance for 40. So you worry if that cutoff gets redefined, how that's going to then spill over into eligibility for other benefits that may not be directly tied to it, but that's how an employer may define it. So it's interesting how you can look at how, you know, a decision in one area may, you know, kind of have this secondary unanticipated effect in another. So keep watching.
Thank you.